Welcome to Meeting of the Minds, September 10th, 2023 edition. Today is open discussion. I do have two topics that I think are very interesting. But I promised to let other people talk first, so let's do that. And Adam has lowered his hand. Stephanie had an... No, he hasn't. That was my... Drink was covering it. Adam, you're first.
Okay, I put my question at the in the chat, and it's at the top of the chat.
Can you re-put it, Adam? Because if we came in at the last minute, it doesn't show anymore. I mean, we only get the chat from when we join.
Okay, I will do that. I'm somehow unable to triple click, so let me copy and paste. Okay, can you see it?
Yeah, I got it twice
now?
There. Let me read it. It can't be remembered.
Why don't you read it out loud for the people on the phone?
Okay, that's good. Thank you. The most important foundational principle guiding my choices is everything in reality is or can become known by the application of reason, close quote. Not an axiom, but practically it's foundational as an axiom. What is the epistemic status of this principle? I don't think it's as fundamental. Fundamental does not come in degrees. As the axioms. Well, you say that, not an axiom. Guiding, you think that's the most important principle guiding your choices. What would be its status? First of all, it's validated. I mean, of course it's true, but using that guiding your choices. No, I don't think, I think it has more important antecedents, which are my mind, using mind in a deliberately vague way, is my means of achieving values and staying alive. I don't mean to separate those, but at all times, whatever my purpose, I need to use my mind. My mind is my basic tool.
Can I put
However,
in 2 cents here?
Huh? What's that, Jean?
I'd like to put in 2 cents here because I think that this is Adam holding reason as the supreme and ruling value of his life. And I think principles are really well understood as a certain kind of value. And so that's how I would take this is you're saying reason is my supreme and ruling value, because that's what this means.
Well, that's your interpretation of it. It doesn't say that.
Well, but that's what it is to hold reason as your supreme and ruling value, is that you use it to know reality.
Yeah,
you
but
can use it forever.
I must use reason to know reality.
No,
that's not what the principle says.
No, that's not what, but the value of reason is. The value of reason is, this is the most important thing, I'm fighting for this. That's the difference between understanding reason as a faculty and understanding going by reason, and saying reason is a supreme and ruling value. That's where it has a different place in your value hierarchy.
He doesn't say, I mean, you're talking about Adam as if he weren't here.
Well, what? So let's see what
the principle
okay.
I stated does not mention that.
The reason that I'm asking this question is because I have encountered the proposition that some things are real but cannot be known.
That's what I thought. That's what I thought you were responding to. So let's take it as that, not as I don't think that's the most important foundational principle. It's kind of polemical. It says there's nothing that can't be known by reason. And that's important. Nothing is closed to reason. That's important. And maybe that's what nothing is inaccessible to reason. Everything can be known by reason. So what is the epistemic status of that principle? I think it only comes up when one encounters either from other people or from a situation the temptation to think something is closed to reason. And therefore, if that's right, all right, let's distinguish two things. One is what you might say in argument. The other is what you might remind yourself of to motivate the choice to use reason even here. So a man alone on a desert island could feel, well, I need to weave a net. Suppose he knows about nets. I need to weave a net. I don't know how to do that. I was a security analyst before the shipwreck. I don't know anything about sewing or where I would get string. I don't have that knowledge. I don't see how I'd ever get it. So I'll do something else. And that he would need to remind himself, anything can be learned, and it can be learned by a step-by-step rational process. It may not be easy, but it's not closed to reason. So it's not social or polemical exclusively. It reason doesn't apply itself automatically. So what's throwing me, Adam, is you saying the most important principle guiding my choices. I mean, I don't think it warrants that status. So do you want me to take it to modify to make it the most important principle guiding my choices, or do you want to say what's the epistemic status, whether it's the most fundamental principle or not?
Well, let me give you an example from Atlas Shrugged.
Okay.
Daniel says he'd be willing to jump out of the window of a skyscraper if he could get the answer to the problem that he's working on before hitting the ground. Okay, now it's metaphorical, but I think it's a good expression of my attitude.
I didn't get that exactly from the statement. So you mean I've got to know?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got to know reality. For instance, the scientific method, reason, perception, and logic is my means of knowing, but it's never give up the quest to know. You always need to know more.
But it's more than that, because I also want to counter the idea that some things that are real cannot be known.
So it's sort of, I can know whatever it is, I can know it in principle, and I must expand the limits of my knowledge as much as I can. My life depends on that. Um, So you're again, I mean, you're wanting to go against the idea of giving up in some way, shrugging something off, right?
The idea that there is something that is real but cannot be known.
Yeah, but then it becomes just polemical. Because why would a person ever think that? There's no reason to ever think that. So if you're saying it's a foundational principle of guiding your choices, I think you're talking about the Quentin Daniels, which is a lot more than, it's not unknowable. Reason can get there. It's I must get there. This is my value, and this, and I need to understand. My life depends on it. So I think it's those are two different things. You see?
Yes,
they're related. They're very closely related. Go ahead.
I see that they are two aspects of the same principle rather than two different principles.
All right, then let's find the overarching principle.
Right.
Since existence is what it is, and you are trying to remain in existence, you must use your only tool of knowing it. It's supremely important to use your only tool of knowing it, which is reason. That's a lot. But you want to get in there. There's nothing unknowable. It all can be known, and it's all, or in principle, it must be known. Not you to have to know everything, but the acquisition of knowledge is an absolute good. And there are no limits to it. There's nothing you can't know.
There are no limits to it in the present. Obviously, I cannot know the future choices of other individuals.
Well, that's not a limit,
though. It depends on them.
That's not a limit because once they're made, you know them. So that also answers Brian Lessing's question. What about events that aren't within our light cone? Things that would require information travel faster than speed of light. Well, it turns out information can travel faster than speed of light, many, many, many times faster than speed of light. But let's say you couldn't, or we don't have access. That doesn't matter. That's just a variation on Adam's point. No one is a mystic because they believe we can't know things outside our light cone. We can't know what the stock market will close at tomorrow. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is a thing by its nature that's impervious, if that's the right word, to reason, closed to reason. And this is just by conditions. By the temporary conditions, you are not in a position to get the information to identify it yet. That's not any kind of philosophical problem. So what Adam is concerned with is an area, a subject matter that is permanently beyond reason's ability to penetrate. And he also wants to say, it's important to gain the knowledge that only reason can gain. So it seems like you need a negation of, and there's nothing that, you know, and this guy who says there's something real that can't be known by reason is wrong. Everything can be known by reason, and everything is interconnected and should be known by reason. Not should be, but is an urgent, supreme value to know as much as you can. So this is, along with Quentin Daniels, the author, the creator of Quentin Daniels said, I don't know how I survived yesterday not knowing what I know tomorrow. Not knowing what I know today. So that's the attitude. And then it's on the side. that some people think, or you might in a weak moment think, I can't know that. So what is the wider thing?
Harry,
existence exists and man is conscious of it. And reason is his basic tool of knowledge.
Isn't the idea that there's something in reality that can't be known by reason, isn't that an arbitrary idea? How would you have on what evidence would you have of this? It would have to be.
You can't have evidence in principle because that would require knowing it.
Exactly, right. So it's so that's one of the reasons that makes it a little polemical.
Yeah, it has to be arbitrary. That's interesting. Some assertions could be supported by evidence, but aren't. This one, as soon as they're evidence, it's supposedly evidence for this thing, it's refuted. So it's in principle arbitrary.
Okay. I don't know, Adam. I think I got the answer to my question in what you just said. Because if someone asserts that there is an aspect of reality, some part of reality that cannot be known, then what is it? Can it, if he can identify it, then he knows it.
That's right. I had the same discussion when I was hired at Hunter College in 1972. I was hired by a guy named Charles Sterover, philosopher in the department there, head of the department. And he was friendly and knew I was an objectivist, but he was a Kantian, and we had a discussion, and I was attacking the idea that there could be a noumenal reality that we knew existed but couldn't know what it was. And I said, how would you know it existed if you didn't have any awareness of it? And he said, well, suppose we were in a restaurant. Suppose behind that wall, I tell you there's something behind the wall, but you can't know it. It's unknowable. You don't know what it is, but you know there's something behind the wall. And I didn't have the answer to that, but the answer is, you've identified it. It's whatever is behind the wall. And that would be the first fact about it. That would be its location. And to have a location, it would have to be material, not mental. So we now know it's a physical thing located in contact with the wall, but on the other side. And we can proceed from there to establish the possible attributes it could have and then go look. So to even know where this thing is, so to speak, you would have to identify. If I say Glyx exists, but we can't know anything about it, well, what is Glyx? I don't know. So you haven't said anything. You said exists. So okay, I think we've beaten this one to death. It's not a bad it's not a bad question, and I like your attitude. I share that attitude. Problem at my end, that's lost sound. Isn't it just arbitrary, says Pooja? Yes, living within it. Yes, I was thinking that Edward A., quote, live and act within the limit of your knowledge and keep expanding it to the limit of your life. Yeah, that's a moral principle. Here's an example. Possible topics to discuss is Jose Donas. Possible topics. Is consciousness a brute fact? Yes, but it's not brute. And it should not be reduced to analyze as stated in Opar. Yes. Is conscious. Now, but there's like one major, I'm beginning to agree with Lee here. The term consciousness, because it can be used, I mean, he uses it for subconscious, but I'm going to use it. His criticism applies to the term subconscious. Because consciousness is both a state and a faculty, Or putting another way, a faculty and the operation of that faculty, as other terms are, people always get confused by that. So let's, for the state, you know, the first sentence of ITOE, consciousness as a state of awareness is not a passive state, but an active consciousness, comma, as a state of awareness. So now let's talk about consciousness as a state of awareness and ask, is a state of awareness a brute fact and should not be reduced or analyzed? What would you reduce it or analyze it to? I'm aware. I'm looking out the window. I'm aware of what's behind the window. I see the light. I see the light. Now, what are you going to reduce that to? Firings in my brain? That's not my seeing of the light. Is consciousness possible without neural activity? Who knows? Probably not. Is neural activity necessary for consciousness? Because, well, being alive is necessary. So I think it kind of, it's the whole organism that's conscious. But I think the mainly involved organ is the brain. So this is a non-question. I mean, that's a little harsh. This is a question that comes about from two things. I don't mean in your motivation, Jose, but in the history of discussions on this topic. The failure to distinguish the faculty, which is includes at least physical things, from the state of awareness, which is not physical and not reducible and a primary irreducible fact. That's one thing. And the other thing is the failure to accept that fact and attempting to get around it because one is impressed by claims of neuroscientists. Now, Adam is a neuroscientist. I guess we could call you that, Adam. And I did work, have worked. I was a student and intern for a while at MIT on it. And it's a great field. I debated whether to go into it or philosophy. It was really close call. So I don't mean to run it down, but they know very little. How do you measure knowledge? They know very little in this way. They know a lot about the physiology and the psychophysics. The neural anatomy, but in terms of, science has now found that consciousness is just the ring firing in the hippocampal region. That's nonsense. They aren't even, that would be like saying savages who have lit a fire are close to a locomotive. They're virtually, they've invented the locomotive, but not quite. No. Someday they'll get, you know, maybe they'll get an understanding of at least what exactly correlates with consciousness. So, distinguish the operation and the state. And let me give you something else with the same word. That's not in consciousness. Solidification. It's not a faculty here, but solidification. I hold up an ice cube and I say, here's a solidification. That's the product of a solidification, right? The solidification is the process. Maybe I can take a more familiar term. How about exercise? Yeah, I mean, you know, exercise. Exercise includes um, muscles, gravity, probably some weights. There are isotonic exercises, but exercise, you know, when you say exercise is good, that's one thing. But the doing of the exercise is an action. That's something different. It's not the perfect example. Oh, it is. Gene says, great. How about operation itself? I had an operation. But operations. Operations involve surgeons, right? Where was your operation? Where is your operation? That's not, I have to work it all offline to get the killer example of the difference. But it's not just consciousness where you distinguish, where you use the same word for the capacity to do something and the exercise of that capacity. Maybe someone in chat has it. Roger says affordances. We don't use the term affordances, only Lee uses that. It's not a valid concept. Does neuroscience tend toward pragmatism and consciousness? Well, I'm not qualified to say, but I wouldn't say the whole science is like that. Maybe some of them. I don't think there's a particular tendency. They tend towards materialism because they don't know anything different. Neuroscience typically made disaster assumptions easy to represent. Yeah. Yeah. Anytime Lee is going to attack representationalism, I'm going to join him. Representationalism is Kantianism. But that's not really neuroscience, Lee. That's theories of perception. Neuroscientists don't really get into qua neuroscientists. When they rhapsodize, they do. They don't really get into what's the relation
between. They talk about representations all the time.
It's endemic,
yes.
Dement's not a neuroscientist, he's a philosopher.
No, I'm sorry, we Californians don't enunciate our words properly. Endemic, it's endemic.
Oh, I said endemic or Dement. Yeah, okay.
That's another. Anyway, they use that terminology all the time. That's the way they think. Well, not 100%. You know,
but everybody is that way. But yeah. But when they're in there talking
they're
about...
They're worse. They're also very bad materialists. They're very bad determinists.
Yeah, everybody is.
The list goes on. They're worse.
I agree. But it's not an occupational hazard because when you're doing squid axons, you're not being a representationalist or a non-representationalist. It's in your off hours.
What causes
consciousness?
There's a thing nowadays that's called cognitive neuroscience. It is a misnomer. There's no cognition in their neuroscience, but that's what they call it. And that is the
who would be an example of that, Lee?
And there's a guy named Seth, Anil Seth, who's particularly bad in this respect, and is very famous and is all over the internet.
S-E-T-H.
Yes, A-N-I-L and then S-E-T-H. He's particularly bad in these respects. These are also the same guys that believe consciousness is an illusion. Now, there are other people that do, but it's just worse in neuroscience. It's just worse.
That is hysterical.
Because all there is those axons. That's all there is. You look in the brain, you don't see any consciousness in the brain.
No.
It's not there. All you see is those dendrites and axons, and
that's right.
Professor D is going, I don't know what he's doing exactly, but he's going crazy. Anyway, that's all you see. That's all you see if you look inside, open up a brain. And that's all those guys see.
Yeah.
They're materialists.
That's right.
So, you know, it's not 100%.
An egg, When you open an egg, you don't see any nutrition.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah. You see cholesterol. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's...
No, I agree.
Neuroscience basically takes the worst of psychology as their starting point. Neuroscientists.
They take the worst of psychology and philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah. Psychology takes, right. They takes the worst things they can find, and that's what they start from.
Okay. So, now I'm going to jump in with Jay, but I'm only going to devote 1 minute to this. Jay says, if we know C as the maximum speed of light is a hard limit, something is reasonably presumed to exist that we can't see from our frame of reference is not possible to examine. And something behind your head is not possible to examine either unless you turn around. That's not what something unknowable means. But no, C is not the speed of light. C is not the hard limit. That's what the aspect experiment together, Bell's theorem proves. And for references of that, Travis Norson has persuaded me, and I don't know enough physics, but he showed me the reasons that... What?
Oh, consider that as a hypothesis, rather than argue with it. In the context of that hypothesis.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Then how do we deal with that?
Behind your head, it's not possible to examine until you...
No. That's
put a mirror up.
No, you can't. If you have the hypothesis that C is a hard limit on what can be seen, that's very different than the possibility of turning around and seeing something.
No, it's not.
Of course it is.
Because that light is going to reach you. The information is going to reach you. One case, you can get it right away. In the other, you may have to wait a few billion years.
Let me give you this example. You know, if the rate of separation between you and the source of the light is greater than one light year per year, then you will never see it.
But according, you can't make a separation like that.
What do you mean?
You just said if you're traveling away at the faster than the speed of light.
I see us.
One light year more than one light year per year is faster than the speed of light.
So theoretically, and I think this makes sense, if you go back to the concept of the Big Bang, there are things that happened that are moving away from us at a rate faster than the speed of light. And we will never see them. You know, let's say things going, quote, in the opposite direction, unquote, from the of the Big Bang.
I don't think that's, I don't know enough to say, but let's say that's true, then it cannot affect us. So it would be outside the sphere of things that you should even care about. But I don't think that's true. I don't think that
could be part of the point, Harry, is that your point before applies. How do you know about this? Not by sight, because you haven't gotten light from it, but by inference from other things. The fact that Jay actually can state that thing means that he has actually gotten some knowledge through some scientists who did some inferences by things that they can say. It is knowledge.
Gene, let me just respond to that. So... thought experiment, you know, the Big Bang occurs. It goes in all directions spherically, you know, in all three dimensions. We see one side of that because at the rate at which we're going away from it, that's within our event horizon. We can deduce that it's going in all directions and therefore...
That is the power of reason.
No, it's the power of non-reason. You can't deduce it's going in all directions. The whole thing is a conceptual muddle. It can't. What is a direction? A direction is defined in terms of perception. It can't be made coherent. But let's not go into that. It's fascinating, Jay, and you and I can talk about it. But we're losing people.
I'm with Gene. I'm with Gene on this.
Okay.
All right.
No, it is. I'm against you and Gene. But then I just naturally am contrarian. Let's go to another big question. You guys didn't want to discuss my little questions, I guess. What causes consciousness, says Professor D? Isn't that similar to asking what? No, it is not similar to asking what causes existence. What causes existence would have to be something that exists. So it's a ridiculous question. But what causes consciousness would not be consciousness. Something causes consciousness. And what causes it? Check back in 200 years. Some property of living organizations of matter. Trained perceptual systems. I don't know what that is, Jay, but let's not go in there. Ray affordances. Harry does not accept this as a valid concept. Lee does so, and so do I. Well, you can, that can be cured. It's the attributes of entities that inform a trained perceptual system to capabilities for interaction with them. I'm responding to you.
Yeah, that should be a trained perceptual system.
Let's get to some non-technical stuff.
That's a trained perceptual system. That's what I meant to say.
Yeah, I got that.
I'll get
it. Just said I get this weird. What do you call it? There's a word for it. A little in computing, you get a little balloon with a, what's that called? Tag or something?
You get a balloon in computing.
A balloon with, you know, next, it's like a box, a dialogue box, but it's just a little tiny thing.
A reaction. About an inch across.
Pop-up?
What? Pop-up? Well, it's not really a pop-up. It's a subcategory pop-up that...
an emoji?
Has its own name. When you hover your mouse and a little thing appears?
Oh, okay.
Huh?
Tooltip. No? Tooltip.
Well,
it doesn't matter, screams Gene from the other room. Okay. I'm getting this blocking off parts of the chat. And when I try to, I see if I move my cursor away, it'll go, it'll put it somewhere else and then I can read it. Okay. Does this relate to object-oriented programming? No. I don't think entanglement Bell's theorem overcomes the objection. It doesn't. All right. That's too, still too technical. Zellinger, Adam references. So we're going on. Churchill, don't mention the Churchill. Oh, well, you mentioning them to drag, to attack them. That's good. Okay. So tooltip. Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Tooltip. Yes. So let's go to one of my topics. Their hands up. Gene is yelling his name. Stephanie, Jim. Let's say Jerry, because he doesn't often speak. And when he does, it's wise. So go ahead, Jerry. Yuri.
Thank you so much. But Stephanie was before me. So
I know, but I'm bumping you ahead.
Okay.
Her.
Okay. I got two questions, but probably there is no time for the second one. So just the first one. The phrase, "It turns out I was right." I'm very suspicious of this phrase. I don't think it's ever correct to say epistemologically anything like that. You know, how can something now turn out that, you know, in the past, you know, I was right or you were right, and it only turns out now. So I think it belongs to the contextual knowledge. Two examples.
Okay.
One would be like, and I think it's absolutely clear, the first one, but the second one also I think pretty clear. First one would be like with the anti-vax people now saying all these vaccines are harmful and everything, and you know, we have this and this, and point to various directions. Of course, most of it or all of it is conspiracies. And now let's make a hypothetical assumption. Now we have a new fact, lots of facts, that the vaccine has lots of very bad, you know, long-term consequences. We figure that out, let's say, in half a year or 1 year, And so right, someone
right,
says,
right. I got that one. Yeah, okay.
Okay. Okay.
It didn't turn out he was right. It turned out that he was still wrong. An arbitrary assertion has to can never turn out to be right. And the way I make this point in the book, my book, is if you dream that you meet a redhead and a beautiful redhead that you are going to fall in love with, and you do meet a beautiful redhead that you're going to fall in love with, that is not the redhead from your dream. That doesn't, your dream does not correspond to anything in reality. If something turns up that matches the dream, that's weird, but it is not that, oh, the dream came true. Dreams never come true. They can't. They're not this kind of thing that can come true. And an arbitrary statement, if I say now it's raining in Borneo, and you check and it is raining in Borneo, my statement is not, did not turn out to be true. It was true. It was arbitrary.
Yeah. Got it. Just a quick follow up. I think it's not just in the arbitrary case. What if there is lots of facts pointing to that conclusion, but the person who is saying, "Oh, it turns out I was right." What if he didn't have enough evidence and his sort of conclusion was based on foggy, maybe a little bit confused, incomplete evidence. So I think he still cannot say, turns out, you know, after this new point of evidence that we now have, but did not have before. And he now says, well, it turns out I was right. No, he's wrong. He has not been right then, and he's not right now, because in the context...
Well, you raise a borderline... Yeah. I get it. You raise a borderline case. If he's partially going by evidence, partially going by feelings, or vague ideas that wouldn't stand up in court, the question is, are the parts that he's going by reason independent enough that they're not undercut by what he overlays on them? Or is it all part of one stew where he doesn't know himself what makes sense and what doesn't, in which case he didn't know? But it is this case, I think, is the one we need to differentiate from. There's some evidence that the man who's brought to trial is a murderer, but he's not convicted by rational process and rational jury, because they say there's still reasonable doubt. But they all feel, you know, he may well have done it, but we can't convict. Then later an eyewitness comes and, or he confesses. So we know now that, I would say, it turns out that the proposition he did it was true. Because you had some evidence, it wasn't arbitrary, so it was a hypothesis that was not provable in the earlier context. Now it's proved with certainty, it turned out to be true. But you're mixing in there, so that's an important differentiation. Don't mix in he as a person was doing the right moral thing with the proposition on the evidence submitted. So if we take the proposition of the vaccines create more health hazards than they solve, and the evidence comes out that it did somehow, which is ridiculous, then the proposition... See, in that case, I don't even know if the proposition would have been turned out to be true, but there could be cases where you would want to say the proposition turned out to be true, but the people who were advocating its truth were doing so on religious grounds. And so they were not right. You see what I mean? Their processes were immoral.
Yeah, it very much depends on who says it, right? If someone who does have that context and is even certain, you know, he's warranted to, you know, to say that conclusion. But the same sentence, such and such is, you know, true, should be completely differently evaluated in the context of someone who is not, you know, warranted, because his context is wrong or his context does not warrant his conclusion, right?
Yeah, but I'm making a simpler point. Two people predict a recession in the economy. One person has studied the data and done a very rational analysis and concludes there's a very high likelihood of recession in the next quarter. And then there is a recession. The other person consults the Bible and decides there's a very high probability of recession next quarter. The first person is doing the right thing and making the right inferences. The second person is wrong and cannot turn out to have been right morally or logically in what he did. So his particular actions were neither moral nor logical. That's different from saying, now the proposition, I wouldn't say, you know, the proposition, depending upon who utters it, it's not the same proposition. The proposition based on evidence there will be a recession highly likely in the next quarter could turn out to be true.
I understand. Okay. I was talking about the people, not the proposition itself. Yeah. The people. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what turns out, even for instance, with Trump and the election. Suppose God reveals himself on earth and says, yes, Trump actually won the election. There was massive fraud in 5 states and blah, blah, blah. It turns out, you know, I saw the whole thing from my God's perspective. And or you take some rational way of finding out. Yeah, it turns out that was based on entirely on massive, unprecedented fraud, and he should have won the election on procedure. That would not make any statement that any of them made moral. Giuliani, Trump, Sidney Powell, because they could not have known that on election eve when they started saying it. They could not. It would have to be God to know that. So those statements are immoral, treasonous. I think they would come in the category of treasonous, but they're certainly immoral and irrational, illogical to say on election eve or the next day, there was massive fraud, we actually won. That's you'd have to have ESP or be divinely inspired to know that. Okay, so there are other hands, right? Okay, Stephanie, can you make it quick? Since I pushed you aside.
Yes. Okay, my question is to ask you about poker and the philosophical issue that comes with a misdeal. I've heard tell there are philosophical issues.
That is too deep to go into, Stephanie. That is, you know, certain people and I are fighting to the death over that. And I could be bought out. I'll change my side if I get enough money.
Oh, I just wanted to hear what your view is now, because
I don't really have a view. Whatever Peter says is the opposite, as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
My view is flips when his view. Sometimes we trade views and start arguing that. No, it's a hard question. I mean, there is no good answer to it. Okay, let's go to Roger.
Oh, thanks. Do you have any advice as to how to not fall into pragmatism when engaging with academic or other disintegrated disciplines?
I'm sorry, how to not fall into what?
pragmatism when you're dealing with.
Oh, pragmatism.
Yeah,
pragmatism.
When you're dealing with. Go ahead.
With academics.
Yeah, particularly when you're forced to deal with concretes that have absolutely no grounding whatsoever, no, or principle of pedagogy.
It's not pragmatism. Pragmatism would be the view. Truth is what advances my career. So socialism, the advocacy of socialism and climate stasis would advance my career. So that's true. Those things are true. Don't try and tell me they're not true. That's pragmatism. If you say they're all socialists, they're closed-minded, they don't want to debate and argue, I'm kind of feel out and get the vibrations, they don't want to argue and they're my superior, I'm not going to raise it with them. I'm going to not give them grounds to think I disagree. I'm not going to actually agree. That's not pragmatism.
I mean more in an epistemological sense, when you're forced to familiarize yourself with concretes that exceed the quote crow epistemology, because the connections are not being explained. There are no principles. How do you not devolve it? I mean, before particularly the issue that's arising for me is, how do you differentiate between polemical academics as opposed to evidence being presented in an academic context?
Give me an example.
I'm drawing upon what Dr. Peikoff spoke about when he was oscillating between Ms. Rand's feedback his.
Uh-huh.
So in my, I hate to bring it back to this all the time, but every single time I'm engaging with a math or a physics class and I'm seeking pedagogic principles, even if it just means understanding the algorithms I'm responsible for,
mm-hmm.
the question is met with such outrage that I'm not really able to get any kind of answer. And I'm having to memorize things so profoundly so often that it's kind of violating the crow, as it were, which, I mean, it could just be an issue of time, but hoping to optimize that. Again, it's just about concretizing. How do you do that?
Can I put in 2 cents here?
Yeah, because I don't have an answer exactly. Go ahead.
So there are 2 things. One is, I think that if you go into academia, you need to recognize that in order to succeed, even just in classes, you do actually need to automatize the context of the teacher. And that is a problem. You need to automatize it to be able to understand the exam. And you do need to do this double entry bookkeeping that Leonard Peikoff talked about. I mean, that's why I didn't get a PhD. I did 2 years of that. And then I went to the OGC and I decided I'm not going to do that to my mind.
The OGC is the Objectivist Graduate Center, the precursor of Ayn Rand University.
Okay. Right. Sorry about that. So that is an actual hazard. And the only solution is to just keep trying to do keep connecting it back as best you can. The other thing I would say is that if what you're trying to get is pedagogical principles and they can't answer, it means that they don't know. And so you need to recognize that there's first-handed work to be done here, and you need to figure out where you are and figure out how to get a first-hand attack on this. Because if they don't know, they don't know. If they knew, they would tell you, right?
Without taking up too much time, you could tell me if I am. This is taken on a more ethical tone, which is good. How do you know if somebody who's highly accredited in something like calculus or whatever, they don't know? It feels like hubris, and that's an emotional crow.
No, wait a minute. You said pedagogic. Did you mean pedagogic?
Maybe he didn't.
Yeah, at one point, literally, I asked a professor, is this an input or an output? And she got upset with me. And when that happens enough times, you start to feel like you're insubordinate, which again might just be a self-esteem thing. But in the interest of not wanting to be a rationalist, I've accidentally become a skeptic. And that to me is one area of crow epistemological maintenance.
Is this an input or an output is not a pedagogical question.
It's
do
not.
You mean to a function? Do you mean from a function?
The reason why I was asking it pedagogically is to understand the syntax of what I was looking at.
Pedagogically means to teach.
Oh, pardon me. When I say pedagogic, I mean, how do I interpret the step-by-step procedure that I'm expected to ingest to perform well in the class. That's what I mean.
Oh, you mean like she's teaching it in a way that you can't make rational sense of it and know how to perform?
Yeah, I can't even memorize what they're asking me to memorize. It's not even good intrinsic.
Okay, all right. Then Gene, what Gene says is right. She's not a good teacher. You're not asking what are the rules of good teaching. You're saying, how do I deal with massive material from a teacher who cannot make it clear and is all messed up? Is it a graduate student teacher?
No, but I'm at the community college level. And when I the only sort of differentia that allows me to put it into a different genus, not to get jargony here, is when I work with a Berkeley engineer who's a better tutor than the professors tend to be. And it's for me very confusing because
teaching is not valued in our society. I was going to say certainly above high school, but I don't think it's valued anywhere. Not by the teachers. Of course, there are exceptions, but as a dominant philosophy, everything is taught poorly across the board, from tennis and piano to nuclear physics. So that's a problem. But the solution is to consult other sort. Go on the internet and look for the best tutorial in whatever it is you can find.
Can I add?
Don't
one more
fight
thing?
Your professor, but I do want to disagree with one word Gene used. You don't have to automatize the context. You have to familiarize yourself with it and be able to step inside it.
Right.
But yeah. I think to say automatize it is too strong.
You need to be able to bring it up as a context. Can I add one other thing about not fighting with the professor? Because I do think this is a big issue, because the professor probably does know something. And so one of the things to do is to actually, like, if it seems like the professor thinks you're combative, then go to office hours, not at the class. Go to office hours and say, look, I'm sorry. It seems like I've been combative. I'm really just trying to understand. And then show them the work you're doing and say, so I'm losing you somehow. Can you please help me here? This is what I'm trying to do. Because they don't become teachers. Most of them, particularly at a community college, because I think at a community college level, people actually have a little more desire to teach than at the higher reaches of academia. They actually do want to teach. And if you really show you want to understand this and you put it in front of them and you show what you're trying to do,
however,
you may be able to communicate better.
Dean is absolutely right. But I think it'd be faster to go on the web and look for good tutorials. And
if he learns to do that, he'll get more out of every teacher he runs into.
Do we have the time for me to ask a quick follow-up to what Dr. Binswanger said, or do we need to move on?
I think we should end and do this in a chat. Now, I didn't get by a chat. I mean, you know, the follow-on after party, we sometimes call it. I've got two topics that I'm happy not to discuss, but I just want to let you know what they are. One is, what is woke? I started dreaming about that last night, so I'd like to kind of discuss that.
Maybe next week, Harry.
Yeah, maybe next week. We're not meeting next week.
Oh, right. No meeting next week.
No meeting of the minds meeting next week. But 2 weeks we could. And the other was, what does it mean to integrate into your total sum of your knowledge? No concept man forms is valid unless he integrates it without contradiction to the total sum of his knowledge. How do you do that? So I have an answer, by the way. So we can discuss that in future MLTM. Let's thank everyone for coming. And thank you, everyone, for coming. And draw a line here and then continue in the breakout rooms or whatever we have. Gene, did you want to raise a question first before I get off about the breakout?
Nope, okay. I want you to stop.
So thank you and goodbye until 2 weeks from today.